You can celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation by listening to a special Reformation service on Tuesday evening, October 31st, live from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will be preaching. Join us for a live Reformation service Tuesday night, Reformation Day, 6:30 Central, 7:30 Eastern, 5:30 Mountain, and 4:30 Pacific at issuesetc.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app.
As we have been seeing in our in-depth series on the Reformation with Dr. Cameron McKenzie here on Issues, etc., the Reformation was hardly isolated to that little town of Wittenberg in German territory, or one man, Martin Luther, or even his circle of fellow reformers. Even as Luther is undergoing the birth pangs of the Reformation, so to speak, it's popping up elsewhere. It is advancing in a lot of ways through many different streams in several different divergent directions and not always meeting with success. It seems to take a different shape wherever it goes. We heard about that in our discussion of the Reformation in England. Last time we talked with Dr. McKenzie, we're going to see it in the countries of Scotland and of France as we talk about Reformation and reversals. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Cameron McKenzie will be with us for part 7 of our 9-part series on the Reformation. Today, Reformation and reversals in Scotland and in France. Pastor Peter Burfind will join us to talk about how not to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. He's got some things that people are going to be celebrating, sad to say, but you shouldn't be doing it. Dr. Larry Rasht will be our guest to talk about Holy Communion in part 5 of our series on the Conservative Reformation. Pastor Chris Roseborough joins us for this week in Pop American Christianity. Today we're going to talk about post-Hurricane Harvey sermon that was preached by Joel Osteen. His church, by the way, is in Houston, Texas. It's titled When the Water Breaks. We'll see what Chris has to say about that. Then, since it's Friday, we're going to be playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week in the last half hour of the program. We'll play 4 soundbites for you, and then you can give us a call, send us an email, a tweet, or go to our Facebook fan page, and you can vote for one of them to be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. Or you can vote in advance for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. facebook.com/issuesetc. Joining us for part 7 of our 9-part series on the Reformation today to talk about Reformation and reversals in Scotland and France, Dr. Cameron McKenzie, professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Nice to be with you again.
We are going to explore some terra incognita, some genuinely kind of unknown lands of the Reformation for most people, I would say the vast majority of people, the Reformation in Scotland and in France. But why are we telling these two stories of, well, the Reformation successful and not so successful?
Well, I put them in the book in order to illustrate the fact that the Reformation was experienced to one degree or another wherever the Pope and Catholicism had existed. The Reformation is a phenomenon of the Western Church, so we don't get beyond the borders of Europe, but nonetheless, all over Europe, the church experienced a Reformation. We choose France and Scotland for a couple of reasons. First of all, France was and still is one of the most important countries in Europe. In the period we're looking at, it was on its way in the 17th century to becoming the most powerful of the continental lands. And it would have a tremendous impact upon the rest of Europe and indeed through colonies and so forth around the globe. So it makes a difference if it was Catholic or Protestant. And in fact, in France, it was kind of a close thing. I mean, maybe people wouldn't all agree with that, but nonetheless, I think at certain times, French Protestants could say, hey, things go a little bit our way, we may end up with a Protestant country somewhat similar to England. On the other hand, Scotland, though not clearly in the same league as France in terms of European importance, nonetheless, in terms of the experience of Americans, the fact that Scotland became Protestant and established a Presbyterian church as the official church of Scotland was of direct relevance to the United States. It was, in many instances, it was Scottish immigrants who brought Presbyterianism with them. And so if you recognize that the Presbyterian Church is a major, major denomination in America, in large measure we have the Scots to thank for that. And so their Reformation has direct influence upon the current American scene. So for those reasons and others as well, it made sense to talk about them in a book devoted not just to the Lutheran Reformation or not just to the English Reformation, topics that are probably more familiar to a lot of the audience, but to just tell people that the Reformation affected other lands as well, and lands that would become important or were important and would have an impact upon church history and indeed cultural history generally, even into the 21st century.
Let's begin with Scotland, and if you would, how and in what form did the Reformation come to Scotland?
Well, Scotland, like other parts of Europe, was part of Catholic Christendom. And when Luther, especially, but also others, began to publish works in Latin, they were, at some point, even in the 1520s, available to readers in the intellectual world in places like Scotland. Now, it so happened that one of the first Scottish reformers, a fellow by the name of Patrick Hamilton, studied on the continent, and there he was exposed to Lutheran literature and embraced the cause, so to speak, and brought it back with him to Scotland. And as a young man, he began to advocate for, let's use a generic, Protestant religion, in spite of the fact that, as was true in a lot of other places, the church authorities didn't like the critique, didn't like the message, and so he ended up getting into trouble. In fact, more than trouble, he ended up being arrested, tried, convicted, and finally burned for heresy. Now, that was in the 1520s, so it's really quite early in the story of the Reformation that we get not only a Scottish Protestant, sometimes he's called the Scottish Luther, but also then a martyr for the Protestant faith. So you've got examples of people like Patrick Hamilton who come in contact with these ideas and embrace them.
So what happens there? Can you go into some detail of how it progresses?
Sure, sure. So we know that the ideas are current to one degree or another among some of the people who have access to this literature. And they are themselves preachers and have opportunities to spread the word. But in Scotland, as in a lot of other places, the leaders of Scottish society, nobles, kings, courtiers, and the like, will often be motivated to adopt Reformation or not, depending on their political interests. Now, in Scotland, for most of the 16th century, the royalty did not adopt the Reformation. So even when Henry VIII is breaking from the Roman Church, his nephew, James V, who's the King of Scotland, does not break from the Roman Church. Now, you might say, well, aren't they family? Why wouldn't he? Well, Scotland and England, through the course of the Middle Ages, were not friends, but rivals and often enemies. The English kings were always claiming to be kind of feudal overlords of Scotland, and so there's a lot of tension. So in the 16th century, if Henry's going to go Protestant to one degree or another, kings of Scotland probably aren't going to. And so the royal family of Scotland became supporters of the Catholic Church. Okay. But you also will have people, again, among the leadership, the aristocrats, who are themselves alienated from the throne. And so to justify some of their activities, they will gravitate toward Protestantism. So politics and religion are still going together, and you're getting a polarization in Scotland over political and religious matters together. Now, in addition to that, you have some of these preachers who are bringing the word back and getting the word out. For the most part, Scotland remains pretty safely ensconced in the old religion, in Catholicism, until in the 1540s, James V, the king whom I just mentioned, dies, and he's still a young, relatively young man when he does die, and his heir is an infant daughter, just about a week old when her father dies, and so the monarchy is going to become significantly weaker than it had been previously, and that will permit the polarization to accelerate, and it will lead to the sides adopting different religious positions in order, as I said, to kind of help justify their opposition. So that little baby girl is known in history, and I'm sure a lot of the audience has heard of her, as Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary, Queen of Scots. Her mother was a French noble lady, and Mary then, or I should say Mary's mother, was a strong advocate of maintaining a traditional alliance between Scotland and France. In addition to that, Mary's mother found support from the leading churchman in Scotland. He was a Roman Catholic cardinal, and he, under the reign of Mary's father, he had helped to build up the French alliance. So on one side of Scottish politics, then, you had Mary, the little baby, her mother, people in favor of the French alliance, and the Roman Catholics. So on the other hand, it was natural enough that you would have some of the nobility who wanted more local authority for themselves, who were pro-English because basically it didn't make sense for England and Scotland to keep killing each other, especially since the Scots were always losing. And finally, Protestant. And so you've got this polarization occurring, even as Mary is an infant and then as a toddler. And that persists through the 1540s and into the 1550s. For the most part, the Catholic French faction remains in power. Protestant spokesmen, preachers, people like George Wishart, for example, are caught, arrested, convicted, burned at the stake. One of the most famous of the Scottish Protestants in the 1540s and 50s was John Knox. And he was one of Wishart's followers, and he, as a result of his involvement with the Protestant cause, he was sent into exile and actually served as a galley slave in a French galley ship. But at any rate, you've got the polarization, you have some of the preachers, you have female ruler, and that female ruler, Mary, Queen of Scots, at one point actually leaves the country. She's only about 5-6 years old, and her mother arranges for her to be brought up in France in preparation for an eventual marriage to the son of the King of France. So the actual monarch of Scotland isn't even in Scotland any longer. Meanwhile, nobles who want more power, want to be pro-English, are also pro-Protestant, They're looking for opportunities to take advantage of the political situation. And finally, they find it. This is in the late 1550s when Elizabeth becomes Queen of England. She proves willing to send money and troops, actually also British ships, to Scotland to support the Protestant nobility over against this Catholic-French alliance that had been running the country. And so you have foreign powers also invested in the Scottish situation. And in that contest, it's the English noble Protestant side that wins. They're helped by the fact that the Queen Mother dies, and there's really nobody kind of on the scene to take over from her and to maintain the Catholic French position. So the Scottish Protestant nobility get into the driver's seat, and they're able to permit John Knox and other Protestant preachers by this time to actually set up a Protestant church in Scotland, while the Queen of Scotland, Mary Queen of Scots, isn't even there. She's still in France. So it's kind of a complicated story, but that's what the Reformation is in this period. It's a complicated story in which political and religious interests, foreign policy interests, all kind of work together to tell a complicated but really kind of an interesting story as well.
We'll talk a little bit more about the Reformation in Scotland and the actions of the Parliament there to enact reform with Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Stay tuned.
You can celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation by listening to a special Reformation service on Tuesday evening, October 31st, live from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will be preaching. Join us for a live Reformation service Tuesday night, Reformation Day, 6:30 Central, 7:30 Eastern, 5:30 Mountain, and 4:30 Pacific at Issues ETC and on the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app.
If you plan to buy one item commemorating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, I highly recommend the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. It's titled The Reformation. You'll want to display this richly illustrated book on your coffee table, in your church library, or anywhere you can easily flip through this informative and beautiful book. The Reformation is written by regular guest Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Learn more about The Reformation at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Friday afternoon, it's part 7 of our 9-part series on the Reformation today. Reformation and reversals. We're talking about the Reformation in Scotland, and in a little bit, we'll turn to the Reformation in France. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. Things proceed pretty quickly for the Reformation there, insofar as it is in Scotland, with a parliament, you even call it a Reformation parliament, as it did in Great Britain, enacting into law the Reformation around 1560.
That's right. Now, it's interesting that the Reformation Parliament in Scotland is not called into existence by the monarch, but it's really summoned by the victorious lords of the congregation, the nobles. And yet they do authorize the creation of a Protestant form of worship and also a Protestant confession of faith. And in the preparation of those documents, John Knox was probably the leading author or creator of those things. And so they put Scotland on the path to an authentic Protestant Reformation. The important thing to realize, though, of course, is that's just the beginning. None of these reformations actually change people unless they persist for a long time, and it's only over a period of generations then that the Scottish people hear this new message and practice this new religion and become used to it. So, but it does start there right around 1560. On its way, when Mary, Queen of Scots, comes back, finally, this is about 1561, and she's still a Catholic. And so you've got like the second act in which you have a Catholic monarch and a Protestant establishment. And so the question is, well, will Scotland continue on the Protestant path, or will the Queen be able to bring it back to Catholicism? And that, too, is an interesting story. Mary, Queen of Scots, eventually fails, and she's her own worst enemy. She's getting involved with men, and these men aren't really particularly good for her. And so she finally ends up being forced to abdicate the throne in favor of her son, who's just a toddler. And she ends up leaving Scotland, taking refuge in England, where we get in a whole nother chapter to her life. But it's no longer on account of Scotland and the Scottish Reformation. She'll be a pain in the side to Queen Elizabeth as the closest Catholic claimant to the throne of England. So at any rate, it's an interesting story, but around 1560, Scotland takes this turn, definite turn, legally speaking, toward the Protestant faith of the Presbyterian variety.
So when you say that, just this is something peculiar to kind of the British Isles Reformation, this term Presbyterian.
Yeah, the term is, but not the reality. Basically, in a Presbyterian type of church government, the power over let me put it this way. In the traditional system, Christendom was divided up into territorial units, each of which was called a diocese, and it was presided over by a bishop. Now, if you can imagine getting rid of the bishops and replacing them by a committee consisting of representatives from each congregation, representatives who are called elders, an elder being either somebody who's the preacher in a particular place, the pastor in a particular place, or somebody who's been chosen by the congregation to assist the pastor in discipline of the members in that place. In other words, preaching elders and ruling elders. Well, every congregation has them. They send them to this committee, and this committee exercises authority over the congregations in that territory. Well, the committee can be called different things. In Geneva, they called it a consistory. In the Netherlands, they called it a classis. In Scotland and England, they called those committees presbyteries. And that's just a fancy word for a committee consisting of elders from the local congregations. Well, that committee, that presbytery, makes the important decisions regarding who's going to be the pastor in a particular place. They test the candidates. They authorize the ordination of the candidates. When a church falls vacant, they take responsibility for making sure that the next pastor gets into that church. They also would be exercising church discipline. Church discipline might start on the congregational level, but the presbytery could be the final decision maker. In a Presbyterian system like Scotland, where it's a big country, you might have another level of church government, the presbyteries being organized into much larger districts, and the district having some kind of assembly that might meet. And finally, again in Scotland, you would have, for really big problems, a national synod that would meet, and the representatives at the national synod would all be delegates from the presbyteries, and they in turn are delegates from the congregation. But a national synod wouldn't be making decisions about routine matters, as, for example, who's going to be a pastor in a particular place. But if there were a big doctrinal controversy, that would be the kind of thing that would be settled at the national synodical level. So the management of in a Presbyterian system really, for the most part, resides in that presbytery, that committee made up of representatives from the various congregations in that area.
I want you to talk about three documents. The Book of Common Order, not to be confused with the Book of Common Prayer, the Scots Confession, and the Book of Discipline.
Well, those are the kind of three, kind of the charter of Scottish Presbyterianism, the religion that John Knox helped to establish there in place of Catholicism. As you might expect, the worship is a simple form of worship. It revolves about preaching of the word, and the kind of worship would include also the singing of psalms, reading of the scriptures, prayer, of course, and then preaching. Periodically, they would also celebrate the Lord's Supper, and that too would be a simpler form. You would use ordinary bread, I mean good bread, but not unleavened wafers, certainly not wafers. You'd use a loaf and you'd break off pieces from it. And people would sit at a table to receive the elements as opposed to, you know, kneeling to receive them. So very simple, an attempt to what they thought replicate what had taken place at the first Lord's Supper, but with particular emphasis upon preaching the word. Simple, revolving essentially around the proclamation of the word. What was the second one?
The Scots Confession.
Oh, yeah, the Scots Confession, yeah. Well, there the Scots follow what had been put into place by earlier generations of Protestants, Lutherans, and Reformed. They wrote up a statement of faith. It is a typical Reformed statement. Biblical authority, justification by faith alone, double predestination. The one kind of wrinkle on it might be that this is one of the Reformed confessions that adds discipline, church discipline, to the marks of the church. You know, Calvin, like Lutherans, taught that the marks of the church, that is the place where you could actually know that the church was there, consisted of word and sacrament, true teaching of the word, right celebration of the sacrament. Well, Knox added to that discipline, so that the true church will be found not only where you have word and sacrament, but where the church practices church discipline. So the Scots Confession is a Reformed document. There are others like it, but it's not pure Calvinism, even though I don't think Calvinists generally would object to that. And then the last thing, which is the Book of Discipline, that has to do with the form of church government that we were describing before.
So how does this look today in Scotland, and have there been, in particular in the United States context, where will we find kind of the general descendants of this kind of Scottish Reformation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there still is a Church of Scotland, but it is, like a lot of other national churches, more nominal than it is really confessional. They've still got the organization, and the various bodies meet in order to do their job for the church. you might find Orthodox Christians in that communion, but you certainly don't have to be an Orthodox Christian to belong to those churches. They're national churches, so you want to belong, you belong. If you don't, you don't, but it doesn't matter, confessionally speaking. Complicating matters, at least slightly, in the story of Presbyterian history is the fact that in the 17th century in England, when they experienced their civil war and the Puritan Revolution, which was an attempt to replace the Church of England by a more purified form of Christianity. You remember the Puritans and so forth. Well, anyway, in the 1640s, the Parliament there authorized the meeting of a church assembly, and this was held in Westminster. And to this church assembly, there came delegates from Scotland, and the English Presbyterians, along with the Scottish representatives, dominated that assembly and produced the Westminster statements of faith, the Westminster documents, Westminster Confession, and two catechisms. And they became characteristic of the Presbyterian movement, even to a certain extent in Scotland. So in this country, whenever there is, whenever you run across a school or a seminary or a publishing house that has the name Westminster in it, then you would know that you're dealing with an institution that at least originally was Presbyterian. In this country, if you put all the forms of Presbyterianism together, it's one of the largest of the Protestant denominations. Like many, however, the majority of the Presbyterians belong to just one Presbyterian church, and that one Presbyterian church is pretty mainstream Protestant, so that it's made its peace, so to speak, with all the various isms that characterize America today. But there are some smaller Presbyterian groups that are more authentic representations of the Presbyterian movement of the 16th and 17th centuries. I'm thinking of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, for example, and then one I want to call the Presbyterian Church in America. I think that's correct. That's another one of the conservative Presbyterian churches in the United States today.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. We're talking about the Reformation in this series with him and its reversals, wrapping up our conversation on the Reformation in Scotland. On the other side of the break, moving to the Reformation in France. Dr. McKenzie is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation, a fantastic account of the Reformation. You can see from our conversation going into great and very thorough detail and beautifully illustrated. Find out more about this coffee table book, The Reformation, from Concordia Publishing House. Give them a call, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. When we come back, France has a history of persecuting reformers. Did it manage to hold the Reformation off?
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things: the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us: broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC Rucam. But no matter how you say it, Ad Crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADCRUCEM.com.
This is Pastor Donald Jordan welcoming you to Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Chico, California. We stand upon the inspired, inerrant Word of God and preach Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Students at Chico State and Butte College are welcome to our college group. Our divine service is at 10 and Sunday school at 9. We are located at 750 Moss Avenue, and our website is RedeemerChico.org.
Historic, authentic Christian Radio. You're listening to Issues, etc.
¿Qué dicen y qué significan las 99 tesis de Martín Lutero? ¿Cuál es la historia del famoso himno Castillo Fuerte? ¿Cómo y por qué están celebrando los luteranos el 500º aniversario de la Reforma este mes? Aprende más en la edición de octubre de The Lutheran Witness. Visite acph.org/trylutheranwitness para recibir 6 ediciones para $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpretando a un mundo contemporáneo desde una perspectiva cristiana.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Friday afternoon, we're doing part 7 of a 9-part series on the Reformation. Today, Reformation and Reversals, turning to the subject of the Reformation in France with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Dr. McKenzie, France had a history of persecuting Reformers. We talked about that earlier in our conversation on John Calvin. Did they manage to turn back the Reformation?
Well, not precisely hold it off. I mean, I think it is true, and Christians need to realize this, that to one extent or another, persecution works. At the very least, if you're executing Christians, you have fewer Christians to work with. And even though martyrs give the supreme and best witness to the truth of the gospel, nonetheless, the example of the authorities putting someone to death does make a lot of people have second thoughts. So when France experienced strong Catholic kings in the first half of the Reformation period, under Francis I and Henry II, persecutions were periodic, and the movement did not do a majority of the population. But to answer your question, the gospel, the Protestant gospel, did do its thing, and people did give up their traditional religion and join the movement. Congregations were started. In fact, in 1559, I think it was, right at the tail end of the rule of Henry II, representatives of Protestant congregations met in Paris to actually organize the French Reformed Church. They adopted a confession of faith that Calvin himself had written. So the persecution did retard the growth of the Protestant faith. And if the government officials had continued to be strong Catholic personalities like Francis I and Henry II, it's doubtful that the country as a whole would ever have become Protestant. But nonetheless, there were people responding to the message and either going into exile or creating a church under the cross, so to speak, in 16th century France.
Talk about the early reformers there in France. Who would you note among them?
Well, the early reformers in France were people like Jacques Lefebvre d'Étaples, who was a Renaissance humanist, a contemporary of Erasmus, and somewhat of the same general bent as Erasmus, that is, somebody who was urging a return to biblical Christianity for reform within the Catholic Church. Now, in some of Lefebvre's writings, he did seem to anticipate insights that Luther would later make famous, things like justification by faith and biblical authority and so forth. And he participated in a inner reform movement of the French Catholic Church, led by one of its bishops, Bishop Brissonnet of the Diocese of Meaux. So those kinds of activities, they came to naught, however. The defenders of orthodoxy were too much, really, for Brissonnet. And so the work of trying to reform the church from within didn't work. Nevertheless, Lefebvre was instrumental in training and inspiring others. And among them, we might mention Guillaume Farel, William Farel, who was the man who recruited Calvin to the Reformed ministry in Geneva. So individuals like Lefebvre and under Lefebvre's influence were at work within the church and sometimes moving outside of the church to try to create a French Protestant movement, and did so with a degree of success. But as I said before, as long as you had these strong French Catholic monarchs, you probably weren't going to get a full-blown Protestant reform in France.
You mentioned a bishop, in fact, Guillaume Brissonnet.
Brissonnet, right.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that kind of attempt at internal reform.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, I think the reformers of all stripes would have liked it if the hierarchy had responded favorably to their calls for returning to a more biblical form of Christianity. And Brissonnet was an example of someone who did just that. He was the came from an important French family, and it was often the case in these noble houses. He was the son who was designated for service in the church. And so he became eventually bishop of Meaux, and decided, under the impact especially of Lefebvre, that he was going to try to reform the church. And that meant two things. First of all, preaching by men committed to the same vision of reform, especially. And secondly, that vision of reform was going back to the Bible, what the Bible taught and what the Bible exhorted in the form of the Christian life. So he brought in Lefebvre and a host of young preachers and put them in various spots in the diocese to preach the Bible and to advocate biblical piety instead of the old forms. What happened is that, well, let me back up for a second. The King of France, Francis I, had a soft spot in his heart for this kind of reform, especially Lefebvre. And so as long as Francis I was around, people who advocated reform from within without challenging the power structure perhaps could get away with it. But in the mid-1520s, Francis decided to engage directly in the Italian wars being fought against Charles V. And at the Battle of Pavia, which was, I believe, in 1525, the French not only lost, but the King of France was taken prisoner and held for ransom. And basically what Charles wanted was guarantees that these Italian wars would be over and France would let Charles have a free hand in Italy, would recognize his claims rather than pursuing their own. So it took a while for Francis to get back home. While he was gone, his mother, Louise of Savoy, was the regent, and she was a very capable ruler. She had served in her son's place on another occasion as well. But one thing she wasn't prepared to do, and that was to protect Brissonnet and his reform movement. The defenders of traditional medieval Catholicism were concentrated at the University of Paris in the theological faculty, called in those days the Sorbonne, and they charged Brissonnet, Lefebvre, and the other preachers with heresy. And so the pressure was placed upon the Meaux reformers, and basically they lost. Brissonnet decided not to fight. People like Lefebvre and Farel left. Lefebvre, not remembering where he went, it might have been Strasbourg or something like that. And it wasn't until Francis was released and came back that some of these men were able to return to France, but they had lost their chance in Meaux. Brissonnet was not interested in picking up the cause again.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc., part 7 of our 9-part series on the Reformation today, Reformation and Reversals. We'll talk about the important affair of the placards in France with Dr. McKenzie after this.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Religious liberty. Christians engaging the media, the For You of Christianity, Christian marriage, the sexual revolution, the Benedict option. These are some of the topics for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $120. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
Casting Christ's net on the internet. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. Kind enough to join us for part 7 of our 9-part series with him on the Reformation today, Reformation Reversals. We're talking about the Reformation in France. Dr. McKenzie, if you would, I think we might have discussed this when we were discussing the Calvinist Reformation with regard to John Calvin while he was in France, but talk about the affair of the placards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting one. As I said, Francis I wasn't completely hostile to reform, but one thing he did not like, and that was challenges to the social and ecclesiastical and political hierarchy, the structure, the way things were organized, who was in charge and the like. After all, right before the Reformation began, Francis had struck a deal with the Pope whereby he, the king, had the right to nominate the high church officials of the church in France, so in effect controlling the patronage of the church and therefore able to reward loyalty and service to the king by appointing men to church offices. So it was a pretty good deal, and Francis wasn't interested in anything that seemed to threaten or to challenge that. So some of the reformers who were authentic Protestants got tired of waiting around for the hierarchy and for the king to accept Reformation. In 1534, one of them, a fellow by the name of Antoine Marcourt, prepared some placards or posters. These posters included kind of a diatribe against the medieval mass. And it was really kind of an essay written on a poster that accused the mass of being just a blasphemy and an abomination. And Marcourt and his team went around on a Saturday night and posted these things in public places so that when people got up Sunday morning to go to Mass, they would read all about how horrible the Mass was, the very thing which they were going on to church for. Well, one of these placards even made its way to the door of the king's bedroom at the royal residence in Amboise. Now, I don't believe that Francis was there that evening, but nonetheless, it showed the audacity of these folks. And when the placards were discovered, the lid blew off. The authorities in Paris started rounding up anybody who was even suspected of heresy or being an advanced thinker, and began to try and execute them. Francis approved of these harsh actions taken. I mean, hundreds were arrested, and I think it was about 20, 25 were executed. And then a few months later, Francis participated in a religious cleansing procession through the streets of Paris, in which they brought out their most precious relics, including what was believed to be Our Lord's Crown of Thorns. So there's this religious procession. It's a penitential procession, so everybody is dressed in black or looking very sober, and these relics are paraded. This is a way of driving the devil of Protestantism out of Paris. And in this procession, kind of the highlight was the consecrated host, which, of course, medieval Catholics believed was the body of Christ, and not just to be eaten for the forgiveness of sins, but actually to be used as a token of God's presence over against satanic powers. Well, it was paraded under a canopy that was held by members of the royal family, and right behind it, the king himself, dressed very soberly, looking very penitential, was walking, showing his identification then with the old religion as opposed to those who had attempted to impose a new anti-mass kind of religion upon the people of France. It was, in a way, a kind of turning point, at least in public perception. Even though the king and some members of his family might still have protected somebody like Lefebvre, they weren't interested in adopting a kind of Protestant attitude toward worship, toward doctrine, toward the Reformation. So it was an important event. People like Calvin realized that there probably was not a safe place for them to stay and work in France, and that was a part of the reason why Calvin ended up relocating first to Basel and then ultimately to Geneva.
So then, with only a minute here, Dr. McKenzie,
okay,
by the end of the 16th century, how would you describe the state of the Reformation in France?
Well, yeah, I hope people will read the book because this stuff is really interesting. But at any rate, by the time we get to King Henry IV, the French Protestants, known as Huguenots, have had their chance to take control by means of force. But it hasn't worked. The king, Henry IV, had been a Huguenot. In order to take rule over his country, especially Paris, he had reconverted to Catholicism. But here in France, it was impossible to make everybody, again, a Catholic. A minority of the population persisted in their Protestantism, and Henry IV actually permitted them a measure of religious liberty. It wasn't done so much out of principle. It was more a result of kind of practical considerations. Nonetheless, it was a step toward accepting the notion of more than one religion in a particular country or state.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. Next time we'll talk with Dr. McKenzie about the Catholic Reformation. Dr. McKenzie, thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Folks, Luther Academy is committed to proclaiming the biblical truths rediscovered during the Reformation to Lutheran pastors and lay people around the world. Find out about this confessional Lutheran worldwide mission outreach at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and be sure to sign up for their free online newsletter, lutheracademy.com. On the other side of the break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Peter Burfind. He's written recently about how not to celebrate the Reformation. Dr. Larry Rast will be with us to discuss Holy Communion in the Conservative Reformation. We will play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week, but before that, Chris Rosebud will be with us for This Week in Pop American Christianity. We'll be right back with Hour 2.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.